Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Alan Joist is one of Ireland's most successful emigrants. Alan grew up in Talla, is currently CEO of the Australian national airline Qantas, earning a reputed $15 million salary a year. Last month, he married his partner Shane Lloyd in a ceremony which Alan joked had to be the most expensive of any Talla man ever. He was referring to the fact that he had given $1 million Australian dollars to the Marriage Equality Act, which was eventually passed in 2017. And I'm delighted to say Alan joins me now on the line from London. Good morning, Alan Joist.
Good morning, Miriam. Great to talk to you.
Oh, great to talk to you. Before we get into you, what is it with Irish people and their success in the aviation world? There's yourself, Willie Walsh, Michael O'Leary, all those people in airplane leasing. What do you think that is?
Well, I think it's the good training. Nearly everybody you mentioned there worked for Aer Lingus at one stage. And I think Aer Lingus were amazingly good at giving people different experience in the aviation industry. I worked in fleet planning, network planning, schedules planning, sales and marketing and IT. And it gives you an amazing foundation. And Aer Lingus were one of the people that set up the first big leasing companies here there in Ireland, GPA, which is the basis of the whole leasing market around the world being based in Ireland. So I think a lot of it comes from the amazing company Aer Lingus was and the training it gave a lot of us and the start it gave a lot of us.
Now listen, let's go back to Talla. Tell me about your parents, Maurice and Colette, and your family and you growing up, Alan.
So I think my parents will always be my heroes. Both of them had to leave school when they were around 12 to 14 years of age. Because they had to go out and work. My father was brought up and lived in the Liberties, my mother in Ballyfermot. They had a very poor upbringing. My grandfather, I think he lived in tenement houses in the Liberties when he was brought up. But one of the things my parents were really keen on was education. Mm. And thanks to the Irish education system where during the 80s we could all go to university for free, that made the difference for our family. And me and my three brothers were able to complete degrees. I did a bachelor's degree in DIT in applied science and then a master's degree in management science at Trinity. And that gave me the job to enter into to Aer Lingus as an operations research analyst, and that started my career. So thankful to the Irish education system, and in particular to the hard work of my parents and their focus on education for their kids.
I gather you're a bit of a maths whiz, is that correct?
Well, I've always been. Two of the four brothers are good at mathematics. My younger brother, he's probably a lot better at mathematics than I am. He's an actuary, which he had to have a first class in mathematics to do it. And the two younger brothers are very artistic. One of them directed for Disney. He's an animation director, and the other's a graphic designer. So two of us have good left side of the brain, and two have two good right sides of the brain.
So listen, how did you end up in Qantas? What was your career trajectory? I know you mentioned at the beginning you began in Aer Lingus. Take me through your career.
So I started really straight out of university in Aer Lingus in operations research, which was building mathematical models for airline problems. Then went into fleet planning, what's the right aircraft, and the purchase decisions on aircraft. Then went into schedules planning, which is where should you fly to and what's the economics of different routes. And I went into IT and sales and marketing, and then got a job working for now the defunct airline in Melbourne called Ansett. Was headhunted by them when I was working in Aer Lingus. Decided that I'd like to work overseas for a while. Came down, worked in that business for around 3 years, and then got poached by Qantas to come over to run their planning division. Then got the job of setting up Qantas' low-cost carrier, Jetstar. So we did that in 2003, and I was the founding CEO of Jetstar, which I did for 5 years. And now for the last 11 years, I've been CEO of the Qantas Group.
And, you know, Into every career comes highs and lows. I mean, you've presided over a huge turnaround in the finances of Qantas. It's doing great now. But there were dark times during your times running the company, weren't there, Alan?
Yes, there were. So I took over just as the global financial crisis was hitting. And overnight, we lost $1 billion in revenue because people weren't traveling in business class or first class. And we also had a period of very severe industrial relations disputes. And then we had a couple of operational issues that occurred, including an engine that blew up on an A380 that had a design fault in it. So there were rocky periods at the start. And then we had to do a big transformation program in 2013, which involved, unfortunately, making 5,000 people redundant, finding $2 billion in benefits of costs and revenue that really turned the fortunes of the airline dramatically around. And now, in the last 4 years, we've produced over $1 billion each year in profits. The share price has gone from $1 to $7, just a record high, actually, today, just over $7. So the market capitalization of the business went from $2 billion to $10.5 billion. And we've been hiring thousands of people in the last few years, lots of promotions, gave $350 million in bonuses to our staff, on top of the standard pay increases that are there, and have given back nearly $4 billion to our shareholders in that period of time. And now very actively out there buying new aircraft, starting new routes, and trying to do new exciting things like flying from London to Sydney. I'm on a test flight that we're flying direct non-stop from London to Sydney, which will be pretty exciting.
That's incredible, actually. How long will that journey be?
It's 19 hours. We did one last month from New York to Sydney, which was 19 hours, 16 minutes. The long sector will be actually Sydney to London, which could be 21 hours in the air. And we're doing a competition between Airbus and Boeing for an aircraft to do that. We're talking to our regulator about changing the flight rules to allow us to do it. And we're talking to our unions about getting the agreements to allow us to do it. So hopefully we'll make a decision on that by the end of this calendar year, when maybe the first regular service taking place in 2023, which will be pretty exciting, I think. It's the last frontier, we think, in aviation. You know, until last year, Australia and Europe were the only two continents that didn't have a direct non-stop service. We started Perth to London non-stop. We don't have quite the range to get to Sydney and Melbourne, but by 2023 we think we will, and it is really the last frontier, the longest distance anybody will want to travel.
I think, Alan, you came out as gay just after you joined Qantas. Was that a difficult decision for you to make?
Probably a lot of people will say, and particularly given my age group, that the thought of doing it is a lot harder than the experience of doing it. And that was probably the case for me. You know, when I first came out, I didn't really want to be the gay CEO. You wanted to be a CEO that just happened to be gay. And I think, you know, when I left Ireland in 96, homosexuality was still illegal. In Australia, I always saw it as a country that probably was going to be more accepting. It had the images of Mardi Gras and what Sydney was like, and I absolutely found that. I think Australia was great, but in some ways there were areas that we were behind Ireland, because Ireland rapidly caught up. Passing marriage equality with the referendum in Ireland before Australia did it, which I thought was amazing. Having a gay prime minister, gay Taoiseach, which I think we might be a bit away from that ever happening in Australia, but I think it could eventually happen. So Ireland rapidly caught up and probably exceeded where Australia was. And I'm pretty proud of both countries. I think both are extremely liberal and progressive, and both have demonstrated to the rest of the world what an open and accepting society is all about.
And I think you've also spoken out, Alan, that, you know, you feel gay, lesbian, transgender, business people, that they should make themselves more visible. Why do you feel that?
I do think, I mean, I don't know what the stats are like in Ireland, but in Australia, still 50% of LGBTI people don't come out and work, and they spend a lot of energy not being who they are or hiding who they are. And the suicide rate of particularly young gay males is now 5 times the national average. So while we think for every generation it should be getting easier, there's still a lot of issues with certain parts of our society. And I think having role models in any part of society is key to making it more acceptable. And as you said, you know, I got married to my long-term partner. We've been together for 21 years, 2 weekends ago. And I think for us, that was also important to show our commitment to each other, but also to show a message and send a message and to give an image of role models out there for that vulnerable part of the community.
And congratulations to you and to Shane on your marriage. Did many of your family from Tala head out there, Alan, for the wedding?
They did. My mother came down, and I had an aunt and my 2 brothers that live in Ireland came down, as well as my brother and his family that came from Melbourne. I've got a brother that lives in Melbourne. So we didn't have the entire extended family, but we had 130 people at the wedding, and it was a good party, as you'd imagine.
Did it mean a lot to you? I mean, as you said, I think you're with Shane, is it 21 years? Did it mean a lot to you to actually get married?
It did. I mean, Shane was born in New Zealand, and he's British citizen as well. So we between the two of us, we actually have 5 passports. He's got British, New Zealand, Australian. I've got Australian and Irish. And the only passport we couldn't get married under was the Australian one for a while. And that's our home. That's our country that we want to spend the rest of our lives in. So Shane worked full time on the marriage equality campaign in Australia for 2 years. He ran the merchandising to promote it. As you said, we committed a lot together to the campaign. So it was very important that that happened in Australia, I believe. I think it was a great message of inclusion and diversity. And it was, you know, very similar vote to Ireland. 62% of the people voted in favour. We had a bigger turnout in Australia, over 80% turned out. And so it was a great message, I think, to send to the community, and therefore very important for us, having worked on it for so long, that it could happen and that we could make a commitment under Australian law, which, as I said, is our country of choice.
In terms of being successful, as you have been, Alan, in the world, when you go to speak to young people, what is your recipe for success? What do you say? Why are you as successful as you are?
I think it's first, I mean, getting the foundations right. Education, I think, is a great leveler from wherever parts of society you come from. If you can invest the time and the effort into getting the appropriate education, I think that does help. I think it's also making sure that you are a good people manager, get good people around you. I mean, I think my success is because I've got a phenomenal team at Qantas. The people that work in the company, I think, are some of the best in aviation. And let people get on and do the job. Some of the best leaders are very humble people. And being humble allows you to have people that question you, allows you to have people that debate with you. You can then change your mind if you think enough information is presented to you that you are incorrect. And I think that's really important, because there's a lot of times where we could have made a wrong decision, but having diversity, having people that were willing to speak up, having people that were willing to debate made all the difference in how we changed. And then I think it's usually the big things. You know, thinking big is what we ask people to do. A lot of businesses, particularly that have been around for a long time, make incremental change. And the big things that Qantas have done, setting up a low-cost carrier like Jetstar, setting up our loyalty program, which is a lot of series of businesses that we've done and taken those risks, have the ones that have paid off for us. And I think sometimes people get into analysis paralysis. They don't make decisions. They're very slow in making decisions. And making no decision can sometimes be worse than making the wrong decision and correcting it fast if it is incorrect. So we try and encourage people to do that, to think big, make decisions fast, and if they're not working, admit it openly and then correct them.
And yet taking big decisions, Alan, sometimes they can be tough decisions. I suppose you mentioned earlier what you had to have 5,000 redundancies in Qantas. Do you ever find it difficult to make tough decisions?
I think you have to have good people around you that's willing to debate and discuss them, and making sure that you're thinking of it from very different angles. And that's why I'm a big believer in diversity and inclusion go hand in hand, to allow you to do that. And then once you've debated it, once you've discussed it, you need to implement it, and you need to be very determined in your decisions and making sure that you're committed to it. And sometimes people either get weak-kneed, sometimes people get this inactivity, you know. And I saw it when I was in ANZUS. It got a little bit into analysis paralysis. I think people knew what they needed to do, but nobody was willing to make the bold, big decisions in order to fix the company. And that ended up with a great airline going out of business. And I've always been motivated as a result to make sure that that never happens to Qantas.
You've been given one of Australia's highest honours, the Companion of the Order of Australia, for services to the aviation industry. Did that mean a lot to you?
I think for me, it was a great recognition from my country, that the work that we were doing. And again, I recognized a lot of people, I think. I never think of these things as an individual, because I recognize the work that we did in Qantas, recognizes the work that I think Qantas and I got involved in for the Indigenous community, LGBTI community. And I think it also helps with the diversity of those awards to say to young LGBTI people that this is a very accepting country, that somebody of my background, I wasn't born in Australia, can run not only the national airline but get the highest award in the system. And I think that's a great message of inclusion. I was at a big event where a young Indigenous lady stood up and she asked me the question, did I ever think an Indigenous lady could run Qantas one day? Because it is seen as the biggest brand in Australia. And I said, well, if a gay Irishman can, then absolutely an Indigenous young lady can. And I think that resonates. And I think getting that award helps that message get out there.
Okay, now listen, you live in Australia, loads of sunshine, beautiful country. Be honest, do you ever miss Ireland?
Of course you do. I think I've got family and stuff, a lot of friends that are in Ireland. Lucky enough, it's working for an airline, I can get back a couple of times a year, which is really good. I don't miss the weather. I don't miss the short winter nights. But Ireland has a lot of positives, and I think it's a country that I'm pretty proud of, as well as Australia. It's a country that it's great to have come from, because I think in Australia it's been a big advantage being Irish, because a lot of people have a lot of affinity towards Ireland, and I think that comes across in Australian society. So it's something you always will be proud of, that heritage, that country, and of course you miss family and friends.
Well, look, Alan Joyce, thanks so much for talking to me this morning. Congrats on all your success. We're all very proud of you. Come back home soon.
Thanks, Miriam. I appreciate it, and great to talk to you.
You too. Take care. Well, Brendan O'Carroll and his alter ego, Mrs. Brown, has, of course, been a massive hit all around the world, especially on both sides of the Irish Sea, with Christmas specials on RT and BBC Now a festive fixture. Well, Brendan and his family will be on tour later this month with Mrs. Brown, the musical. And Brendan joins me now on the line from his home in Florida. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning. Good afternoon to you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now listen, how is everything in Florida at the moment? Is the weather good?
It's unfortunately, it's 32 degrees and sunny. It's very boring.
Oh, well, everyone here is quite jealous to hear that this morning, actually. So listen, you're taking Mrs. Brown on tour. You know, you sell out theatres everywhere. Tell me about the tour. Do you enjoy going back on tour?
Well, I mean, for me, the fun of it, the whole thing is tour. I mean, I'm lucky enough that Mrs. Brown's been successful on TV and in radio and in novels. But honestly, the best part for me is being on tour, particularly with this play, Because it's a musical, we were actually going on tour in Australia on the airplane when I leaned over to Jenny and I said to Jenny, I think I'm going to write a musical of Mrs. Brown. And she looked at me and she went, oh, my God. We've never had as much fun. Honestly, everybody was, all the cast and, you know, everybody was a bit doubtful about it. And they're all going, oh, have we gone mad? But we've never had as much fun on tour as doing this musical. It's absolutely fantastic. What I haven't told them yet is that I'm contemplating Mrs. Brown on ice.
That may be a step too far.
Or a skid too far.
But look, the amazing thing is, you used to sell out theatres like the Olympia, but now, I mean, on this arena tour, you're doing four nights at the SSE Arena, four nights at the Three Arena in Dublin. Did you always know it would be as successful as it has become?
Miriam, I'd love to be able to tell you how clever I am and that I had a plan. I honestly, this is beyond my wildest dreams. People say to me, oh, you must be living the dream. I'm way beyond my dreams at this point. My mother had a great attitude to it. She often used to say to me, Brendan, success is like disco music. Don't analyze it, just dance to it. And honestly, Miriam, I've just been dancing. I just keep my head down.
That's a great saying from your mother. And look, I obviously have spoken to you before about your mother. Just remind people, though, will you, Brendan, for people who might not know, remind us what an exceptional person your mother was.
Well, she started her life off as a nun and went on to have 11 kids. So she obviously was right to doubt her vocation. I think she liked something else more than her prayer, than her altar beads. So when she was pregnant on me, she ran for the Dáil. She became the first female Labour TD in Dáil Éireann. I was born while she was a sitting TD. Mind you, she wasn't sitting when I was born, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And she was an incredible woman in that she had some incredible gumption for her time. I mean, at a time when people who are her age now would remember, it was tough for women then. You know, you were expected to be a good housewife and a good mother, and that was it. And she intended to be a good housewife, a good mother, and to try and change the world. And I often point to some of the laws that she changed that were so anti-women. And one of the laws that she changed, I think it was in 1954, she changed the law that it was legal to beat your wife provided you didn't use a stick thicker than your thumb or longer than your forearm. I mean, that's our take. Mm-hmm. So it was, and because she realized, you know, at that time, again, young kids nowadays wouldn't even believe that a man's home was his castle. If a neighbor rang and said there was a domestic going on next door and the police called to the door, and the man opened the door and said, yes, what can I do for you? And the policeman said, well, we believe there's a bit of a domestic going on here. It's none of your business. And they would say, well, try and keep the noise down. And they'd walk away. And that was the way it was then. So she, realizing that to get women's laws enforced, it was going to be difficult to change the whole police force, she said, well, we should have a women's police force. So she set about setting up the Ban Gardaí, and a great tribute to her. I never forget it, when she died, the funeral procession that we had out to Dean's Grange was lined with Ban Gardaí, who all saluted as her coffin went by. She was a wonderful woman. I could go on and on about her, Miriam. I won't bore you.
She was so ahead of her time. Like, she was a feminist. Were you very influenced by her, Brendan, in all aspects of your life?
Yeah, it'd be difficult not to be, because I was the youngest born, so we were nearly three families, if you know what I mean. She said when she got married first, she bought a packet of sanitary towels and didn't use them for 5 years. She had baby, 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 baby. And then there was a gap, and then there was baby, 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 and then there was a gap, and then a baby, baby, and then there was a big gap, and then there was me. So by the time I came into my formative years, about 9 years of age, my dad passed away. Most of the other kids had grown up and either moved out or emigrated. And it was just me and this genius of a woman. So I would be, you know, getting ready for school, and just before I'd leave every morning, she'd pinch my cheek and she'd say to me, you can be anything you want to be. And I grew up with that sense of, I really can be anything I want to be, you know, that there's nothing that can stop you if you have the determination. And she had some great sayings that I could write a book of her sayings. she had this wonderful one. I used to say, "Mammy, I'm going to kneel down tonight and pray for such and such a thing." And she'd say to me, "Well, if you want it bad enough that you get down on your knees for it, get up off your knees and do something about it." And she was very much a woman of action.
And this musical, I gather one of the songs in your musical, Brendan, is it called A Woman's Place Is in the Kitchen?
Yes, A Woman's Place Is in the Kitchen. which, as soon as it's kind of the boys' scene against the girls. The girls are in the kitchen and the boys are in the sitting room. And the boy, you know, granddad is saying, you know, in my day, a woman knew her place. A woman's place in the kitchen. And as soon as he says a woman's place in the kitchen, the entire arena, and you can picture the O2 in London, you know, with 8,000 people there going, whoa. But the girls really have their own comeback to it, and they really, they floor the boys.
How long does it take you to write something like Mrs. Brown, the musical?
The musical was the most difficult. First of all, writing songs was, you know, Mary, I'm just going to sound terrible, but I'd never even been to a musical. So that's how little experience I had of it. But I kind of wanted to, first of all, the first thing that was important to me was I wasn't just going to do a wishy-washy sing-song of Mrs. Brown. It had to be a funny play. So I wrote the play first. And then started try and make the songs fit the play, and they do. They fit the comedy play really, really well. So apart from the fact that it's the most energetic thing we've done, without any shadow of a doubt, this is the funniest Mrs. Brown I've ever written, and I'm really, really proud of that. But it took me. I think I had it in my head for a long time. When I say a long time, 5 or 6 months. So you'd be going somewhere and you'd have this idea, a woman's place is in the kitchen. That's the way granddad would think. So you write the scene around that and then you go, and there's a song can go with that. A woman's place is in the kitchen, yeah. So, you know, then you start working on the lyrics of the song. And the opening number, I always knew the opening song was going to be Mrs. Brown. And she sings the first song in the show called Independent Dublin City Trader. Because she's singing about Moore Street, and the whole thing is about Moore Street. The whole show is about Moore Street.
And when you do new material like that, Brendan, how do you test it out? I mean, do you just first test it out on Jenny, or do you perform it in front of a small audience to see what works, or do you just know at this stage what works?
It's bit by bit by bit. Unfortunately, with this play, usually we would go to a... We used to open all the Mrs. Brown's plays in the Royal Theatre Royal in Waterford, in a small theatre there, and then, you know, refine them there. And then when we go back on the road, because we haven't done a particular play for maybe 4 years, we would go to a place in Rhyl, the Pavilion in Rhyl in Wales, and we would do it in the theatre there, and we would refine it there and knock out the bits. But unfortunately, this tour, the demand, thank God, was so good, big for this tour, that we were rehearsing right up to the day before we opened in the Hydro Arena in Glasgow. So it had its opening night to 8,500 people.
Wow.
And we were all a bit, you know, very, very nervous. And Danny, my son, Danny, was probably the most skeptical. From the very moment I started writing it, he kept saying to me, "Dad, Dad, Dad, this is mad. Dad, oh, Dad, this is crazy." And one of my... that will live with me forever is that on the opening night when the curtain closed and the lights went down, we came out for the ovation, and there's a standing ovation in the arena. As we're coming down the steps at the back in the dark, Danny said to me, "Dad, this is the best thing you've ever written." And I'll never forget that.
That's so lovely. Look, and you've won so many awards for Mrs. Brown. I think you were voted the number one sitcom of the 21st century. I think you've won five BAFTAs, 4 national TV awards, 4 IFTAs. The show works all over the world, including Australia, New Zealand, Canada. I mean, who goes to the shows, Brendan? I mean, is it the diaspora largely, or is it, you know, Canadians, New Zealanders and Americans and Australians?
Initially you would think that it would be the diaspora that would go. And I think maybe initially... when it came on TV, it might have been the diaspora. But, I mean, that doesn't explain it being... It's been the number one on the TV ratings in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Jamaica, in Quebec, in the East Coast of the United States. Initially, I think it was the diaspora, but I think you can't underestimate an audience, you know. The audience are well able to make the leap that it's an Irish family set in a working class part of Dublin, and this is what they do, and this is how they speak, and this is how they relate to each other. A very, very dysfunctional family, but, I mean, you know, not unlike my own family. Very dysfunctional at times, but as close can be. And you know that this woman, who's a bitch, I mean, I just feel she's a wagon. But at the end of the day, she would lie down and die for her kids, and that's her redeeming fact. That's her redeeming facet, I think, is that she just adores her family. Family is everything to her.
And of course, famously, family and friends is everything to you. I mean, you've most of your family, I think, with you on the tour, obviously including your wife, Jenny. And then, you know, even friends like Rory Cowan, who's left the team, but he says he's still treated by you like family. And why is it so important for you to have people, I suppose, around you, so close to you?
I think it's because, and I don't think it's that it's important to me. I hope it's just as important to them. Is that you find you become part of something that you never expected to be part of. So we're nearly like all adopted children of Agnes Brown. And we got it to do this thing that we never thought would be as big as it is. And when you go from radio, you know, to the stage, and you're, we started, I mean, we did Tala, the theatre in Tala, before we start doing the Olympia, before we got anywhere near the Olympia, that each step up is so scary and so terrifying that you tend to close ranks and depend on each other more and more and more. And it's, I guess what it is, kind of a self-dependency and a self-reliance. And then, now that it's now flowing, thank God, we get the benefit of that, in that you're part of something that's moving along, tripping along, and you're just as important as everybody else in the family. And there's a lot of love there. I think that's mainly it.
I know you were devastated about the loss of Gay Byrne.
Yes, it was speechless at the time. You know, it's funny, Miriam, he FaceTimed me with John Masterson. The two of them were out about 3 weeks beforehand. He FaceTimed me out of the blue. Hello, just checking in, you're all right. I didn't know. It was probably to say goodbye, and I didn't know that. So it was absolutely devastating.
Shag it. Still engaged.
Who's still engaged?
Gay Byrne, I'm ringing all morning. He's engaged all morning.
Deke Gay Byrne, you're ringing Gay Byrne himself?
Yeah, what's wrong with that? He's me only hope of getting a band now for the Nativity play. I'm desperate.
Matt, Gay Byrne's not going to get you a band. He's up to his neck with people ringing, Gaybo, get me this, Gaybo, get me that.
Well, I'm not giving up. Only God or Gaybo can help me now. It might be easier to get God.
Hello, Radio Telefi, Sharon. This is the Gay Byrne Show. Can I help you?
I'm true. Jesus, I'm true.
In a polka dot skirt and standing on one leg, so there you are. We have it. We go to the phone now. Agnes Brown. Hello, Mrs. Brown.
Hello, Mr. Byrne.
Mary tells me you have an emergency for us. Is that right, Mrs.
Yes,
Brown?
Yes, Mr. Byrne, and I wouldn't ring you if I wasn't desperate. You told me the last time I met you to ring you any time I had a problem.
The last time we met, where was that?
Yes, in 1984 in Hanlon's Fish Shop in Moore Street. I sold your lovely wife, Catley, in some fresh halibut.
Fresh halibut?
Yes, very fresh. It's a wonder she didn't put you out with the cat after eating the cake.
Yes. Oh, I do remember. Yes, Mrs. Brown. That Mrs. Brown, of course I remember. Yeah. What's the emergency, Mrs. Brown?
Okay, I'm putting on a nativity play on Friday to raise money for the baby unit in St. Patrick's Hospital.
Ah, St. Patrick's. I know it well. And Sister Bernadette and the nurse is doing a wonderful job in the baby unit there. A good cause. What's your problem, Mrs. Brown?
Well, I have no band. I had a band boot. I gave him a deposit and all, but he's after letting me down. He got he's sick. So now I'm bandless, if you know what I mean, Gay.
Indeed, yes, bandless. Oh, well, don't worry, Mrs. Brown. We'll do what we can for you. Look, musicians, entertainers and showbiz promoters, here's a chance for you to do a little kindness for the Christmas season and help an old lady out with her Christmas play.
Old lady?
Yeah, well, there you are, Mrs. Brown. We'll await the... I'm sure we'll get a flood of offers. Don't worry about it, and we'll pass your number on to them. Is that all right?
Thanks very much, Gay. I knew I could rely on yourself. I'll send you down a bit of fish.
No, Mrs. Brown, that won't be necessary at all. Just you concentrate on looking after all those little children and the good people in St. Patrick's, and I wish you a happy and peaceful Christmas, all right?
Could you get me a cow, Gay?
A cow? We'll take a break here and we'll come back with some music.
He meant so much, not just to me personally, but to the whole nation, but certainly to me it was... I grew up without a father, and he was very much a father type figure.
And he really, I know Brendan Grace, you know, we've mentioned, was hugely important, but it was going on the late Brendan that really made you as well, didn't it?
Yeah, that first visit to the late show was absolutely incredible. It was one of those moments where, you know, on the night before, nobody knew who you were, and the night after, everybody in the country knew your name. It was an astonishing one, and he was so generous because that was supposed to be a 9-minute interview. And I went on, and he just let me go. He let me go for 35 minutes. And I think any comedian who's been on the show will tell you that, as well as, you know, being a great presenter and a great interviewer, he's a great foil. He's a great straight man for a comedian. And he does let you go. And that changed my life. And I think he knew it. I said to him after that show in the green room, I went up and I said, "Mr. Byrne, thank you very much for the opportunity." And he said, "Brendan," he said, I get great fun. I love opening the door a little for people. And it's up to them whether they go through it or not. And I have to say, tonight, you kicked it open."
Oh, absolutely. And I need to mention Brendan Grace to you, Brendan, because I know how close you were. It's been such a sad year with his loss. But would you remind people, because weren't they at a wedding, Brendan and his wife, and you were working as a waiter? Tell that story.
The wedding reception was in Paquin's Club in Dublin. People might remember, but it was a fabulous, fabulous place with a ski resort, and it was a beautiful, beautiful place. And I worked in the Lisa Room restaurant, which is the main restaurant
as
there.
A waiter.
I was a waiter there. And we had weddings at the weekends, etc. And the big wedding we had was Brendan Grace's. It was a huge wedding. He was a massive star. I always remember he arrived by helicopter, him and I in. And it was a wow wedding. And as we cleared the tables and the night became, you know, the wedding reception became a party, and they started singing. One of the waiters who knew Brendan, because Brendan's from the Liberty, so he was friends to everybody. But one of the waiters who I worked with said to Brendan, they used to call me Top Cat in the hotel business. He said, "You want to hear our TC doing an impersonation of Hal Roach?" So Brendan said, "You know, do you want to get up and do a bit of Hal Roach?" So I got up at the wedding and I did a couple of impersonations of Hal Roach. And afterwards, as the wedding started to calm down, you know, people were starting to leave, I went down to our own restaurant where I was having a cup of coffee, and he put his head in and he said to me, "This," he said, "the impersonation was very good." He said, "Well, I know all Hal Roach's jokes." He said, and a lot of them weren't Hal Roach. I said, "No." I said, "Well, you know, I make stuff up and I pick stuff up." So he said, "Look, I'm going on my honeymoon, and after that, I think you'd do a tour of Canada." And he said to me, "Look, would you fancy having a chat when I get back?" And I said, "Sure." And when he got back, true to his word, he rang me and we met, and he said, "Look," he said, "if you fancy coming on the road working for me, you can come. You can work as a roadie as well as help me with the show." And I spent the next 2 years on the road with Brendan, and it was just the most amazing experience. I learned a lot about show business, first of all, but a lot about timing, a lot about comedy, and a lot about the business end of the business. And amazingly, after my very first opening night in the Olympia Theatre as a stand-up, which wasn't today or yesterday, I arrived in an opening night, and there was, of course, a card from Brendan from America to say, "Best of luck, go get him." And it was, you know. So we keep bumping into each other, and he lived, of course, in Tampa for a while. Now he's gone down to Miami. Well, he had gone down to Miami. And with me living up in Orlando, we would keep bumping into each other quite a bit. But what a man, what a gentleman. And, you know, they often say, they call people man of the people, but he really was. He timed for everybody. And the fact that he finished with the choir, that his life ended with that choir, is no surprise to me whatsoever.
No, I mean, everyone loved him. And do you think, in a way, your own career, Brendan, I mean, you probably would have made it anyway, but how important do you think Brendan Grace was in your success?
I think when I decided to make the move, and I didn't really step on the stage myself till I was 35,
When I decided to make that move, all I had learned from Brendan in the past really helped me move things forward a lot quicker than if I'd been just literally a rookie starting out. It had a huge impact on it, a massive impact. And again, you know, the way Brendan would talk about Butler, and the way he would talk about, you know, the Dublin L ones, that very much is the same as what Mrs. Brown is like. Just be yourself. Just be the character yourself.
Brendan, also your health scare recently, and someone saw you on TV and noticed there was something wrong with you.
Yeah, it's very odd because I wasn't sick. I didn't feel sick. I felt in the whole of my health. But I had this thing that I was waiting to get done on my legs, a PAD, peripheral artery disease. I was waiting to get my legs done. And I couldn't get an appointment at the right time when I wasn't touring. So I asked Dr. Alan Byrne, the FAI, we were launching this thing with Mrs. Brown's Boys heart screening for young kids who play football. And we were launching it. It was his idea, and we were funding it. And during that, actually, it was Jenny said to him, listen, I'm worried about Brendan. And he said, well, I'm worried about Brendan. And he said, I saw him on the Late Late Show when they did the live Late Late Show from London. And he seemed to be having trouble with his breathing. And Jenny said, well, I haven't noticed that. So Jenny told him about my legs. He said, leave it with me. And he got me into the Beacon Hospital that weekend. And I went in on the Friday, and they gave me a list of tests that they wanted to do, and they were going to do them all in one day. And before I knew it, I was under anaesthetic, and I woke up, and Jenny said they found a blockage in an artery. They were very happy. They expected to find about 10, and they found one. But the one they found, they said, was 99% blocked. You were about a month away from a heart attack. They put a stent in, and as the doctor told me the next morning, the surgeon, he said to me, he said, the best thing about you right now is your heart. And I said, oh God, that's amazing. I said, what about me legs? He said, I don't do legs. So what it was, Alan then rang him and said to him, listen, he wants you to look at his legs, never mind his legs, look at his heart. So, you know, the nice thing about it was, first of all, I didn't feel sick, I didn't feel unwell, until about 3 or 4 weeks after I got the stent in, I started to realise how well I felt then. I started to realise how tired I was and how slow I was getting before that. So it was really, you know, I would recommend it, highly recommend that anybody over 55 years of age who go in and get stents, whether they need them or not.
Just before I give the dates for your shows, Brendan, do you miss Ireland when you're away? Now, be honest, you're sitting in the sunshine right now in Florida, but do you miss Ireland? And do you stay in touch?
Well, you have to, because first of all, I've 6 grandkids there. I miss it an awful lot. I miss the politics of Ireland an awful lot. I mean, the politics of Ireland make a lot more sense than the politics over here. and I'm very interested in politics, so I'd rather be in Ireland than anywhere else in the world. But at the same time, honestly, I don't miss the rain. It's not even the rain or the cold. It was that feeling, maybe mid-October, where you look out the window at 12 o'clock and you realise that's as bright as this is going to get today. And it can be very, very drag you down a bit. But having said that, you know, the move here has been wonderful for us. And Danny and Fiona and the kids, you know, come out for the summer, and we have summers here together. You think we see enough of each other already, but we spend summers together out here. And I always go to Ireland for Christmas. Christmas wouldn't be Christmas unless you were in Ireland. But then, as soon as Christmas and the New Year's over, it's back over here.
That's so nice. Brendan.
I also find it easier to write here. It's much easier to write here because where we are is nice and quiet. And, you know, it's funny, when people ring the office, our offices in Dublin, and say, we're looking for Brendan, if they hear I'm on tour, they go, well, what city is he in? And they'll track me down there. But as soon as the office says he's in America, they don't even go any further. So it's quite peaceful out here.
Which is great. And listen, you go to Crumlin Children's Hospital at Christmas Day, don't you, Brendan?
I wouldn't miss it. It's really important. I think this is our 11th year to do it. It's not so much for the kids. Every 10 years live, I mean, you know, half the kids don't even know who Mrs. Brown is. But it's really important for the staff. It's really important for the parents. Just to go in and say, listen, we know you're here. We know you're spending Christmas here, and we're thinking of you. And not just the only one. Valerie Keaton organises the day, and there's about 20 of Irish celebrities that go and do it. It's so fulfilling. And at the same time, I step outside and I have 6 grandsons and I have 3 kids, and I thank the Lord Jesus that my Christmas is going to be spent with them.
Well, look, Brendan, as ever, you're always so generous with your time. And Mrs. Brown's Boys, the musical, is going to be at the SSE Arena in Belfast from November the 22nd for 4 performances, 2 evening, 2 matinees. And then in Dublin here from the 13th of December for 2 evening shows and again 2 matinees. All tickets.
To my favourite arena.
Yeah, it's a brilliant arena, isn't it?
It's fabulous.
Is it your favourite arena, the one in Dublin?
The Tree Arena is my without a doubt my favourite, and after that is the O2 in London. But the Tree Arena is just, it's hard when the curtain comes back and the crowd applause not to start crying, not to burst into tears.
Well, look, Brendan, we wish you the very best of luck, and tickets all available from ticketmaster.ie. Go back and enjoy the sunshine, Brendan.
Thanks, Miriam, and tell your granny thanks for the chicken.
Take care. God bless. Bye, Brendan.
Bye-bye.